supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Many people I know, actually myself included, complain frequently that they have trouble with attention and concentrating. There really is so much going on, emails coming in, cell phones ringing, and it's tough to focus on anything. But for people with attention deficit disorder, keeping track of things, getting tasks done, or even listening can be a true chore. About 70% of children who have ADHD carry this disorder into adulthood. Some of them were never diagnosed. So on today's show, we'll talk about what life is like for them, adults with ADHD, what treatments work best, and which ones don't. My guests are Dr. Kevin Murphy and Dr. Ari Tuckman. Kevin Murphy is president of the Adult ADHD Clinic of Central Massachusetts. He's co-author of ADHD in Adults, What the Science Says. He joins us by phone from Massachusetts. Kevin, welcome to the show. Do we have you?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome.
Thank you very much.
And joining me here in the studio is Ari Tuckman. He's a clinical psychologist in Westchester, specializing in ADHD, and he's the author of Integrative Treatment for Adult ADHD. Ari, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
And we want to hear from you. Give us a call. Our number is 888-477-9499. If you have ADHD or suspect you do or a loved one does, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Well, before we get to our experts, let's hear one person's story. Our associate producer, Elisa Walters, spoke with a young woman named Chrissy who has ADHD.
How old were you when you were diagnosed with ADD?
I was actually a freshman in college, which really surprised my mom because I wasn't an oppositional child. I wasn't ever bad at school, so it was a shock to her.
And how was this diagnosis made and what led up to it?
In college, it wasn't like high school or middle school where you could kind of go to class, somewhat pay attention, and then be fine. You really had to study, read, and keep up with everything, and I couldn't do it. And I probably went a good month, and I finally had this just, I was overwhelmed. I couldn't concentrate to even read these long sense of chapters. It was for one class. And that's when my mother and I decided, you know, we'll go make a doctor's appointment, and I gave them symptoms, and then I took a computer test. And that's when they prescribed me to a low dose of Adderall first to see what was the lowest effective dose.
So how did you feel when this diagnosis was made?
For me, I needed something to change in that area of my life. I've always been successful at school, honors classes, AP classes. I didn't have to put a lot of effort into school. And now I'm in college, and I still held myself to those same expectations. So when I couldn't perform to the ability that I thought I was going to perform, that affected me more so than them saying, let's try this. This is what the computer test results said. And afterwards, that's probably, I would say that the Adderall was the biggest changing event in my life when it came to sitting in a class and not doodling and really focusing and hearing what my professors were saying. I actually really was involved in it and really paid attention.
How do you feel it affects the people around you in your social setting, your personal setting, and your work setting?
At work, I definitely think that I can be frustrating. I think that, not that I'm a bad person or malicious, but it can be aggravating when you're trying to get something done and someone next to you either is talking or moving around or, you know, it can be aggravating. And I know when I am taking my Adderall and I'm focused and someone else is distracting me, I feel that way as well.
How do you feel that having ADD as an adult affects the way that you listen to people?
ADD in interpersonal relationships is interesting. I feel like as a listener, I'm terrible because I can talk, as you can see. And basically, it's once I get the response mode and the person's speaking back to me, and I have to actually focus my attention on what they're saying, internalize it, and actually be able to respond to them, I'm already 18 thoughts ahead, you know, and it's rude, it's disrespectful to people, and it's something that I consciously have made myself aware of, so I work on that. But it's really hard to slow yourself down, and I describe my thought pattern as me talking right now, I can still be thinking about the 30 other things in my head, so when I'm listening, that gets multiplied by 5. So it's pretty much just it's difficult, and it's something that I really am disappointed in myself, because I think it's rude.
That was Chrissy talking with our associate producer, Elisa Walters. We'll hear more from Chrissy later on. Right now, we're going to be talking with Ari Tuckman, who's a psychologist in Westchester. He's written Integrative Treatment for Adult ADHD. And Dr. Kevin Murphy is president of the Adult ADHD Clinic in Central Mass, and he's the co-author of ADHD in Adults, What Does Science Says. Ari, let's start with you. So Chrissy was fine as a child, ran into trouble when she got into college. Did she have ADHD as a child, or was it adult onset ADHD?
Well, she absolutely did have it as a child. Kind of by definition, in order to be diagnosed as having ADHD, it had to have been present from the beginning of life. Obviously less apparent earlier in life. And I think that her story is rather common. She's a bright student. She's interested, she's capable, she wants to do well. Unfortunately, in that transition from high school to college, the structure that perhaps her parents provided, the structure that teachers or other people at the school provided, fell away. The demands greatly increased in college, and at that point, she was no longer able to get by, you know, because of her raw natural intelligence, on just being smart and filling in the blanks of what she missed.
This all raises a question. I'm going to turn to you, Kevin, about the relationship between ADHD, the symptoms of ADHD, and the environment. I mean, we live in an environment where our brains are bombarded with external stimuli. I would imagine our brains are more agitated than they were even a decade ago. So at what point is this overstimulation called ADHD?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. That's always a great question to ask, because when we talk about evaluating or assessing ADHD, we're really talking much more about impact of symptoms and the presence of impairment, clinically significant impairment, rather than just the presence of symptoms. Because the symptoms of ADHD, if you look at them, they're pretty common to normal human functioning, and they're also common to a lot of other psychiatric diagnoses. So the challenge for the clinician is to figure out at what point on this continuum of symptoms do we call somebody, label them as having a disorder, and when are they just simply on the perhaps, you know, sloppy, disorganized, spacey side of life? That's always the difficult question. And the yardstick that we use is trying to look at impact and clinically significant impairment. For example, we know that kids with ADHD are at much greater risk for school problems, relationship problems with peers, with grade retentions, with special education, that sort of thing. So we're looking always at the onset and what is the evidence for an early childhood onset, which is required. And for in the case of Chrissy, I think that, you know, one of the things we would do in an evaluation is to look closely at her childhood functioning and look at, even though she may have done well in school, there may have been teacher comments that would speak to her difficulty with listening or paying attention or getting her homework done or sitting still or following through.
Well, let me see if I can help to maybe make this a little less clear here, if I can. I'm a therapist. It's what I do. So I'm thinking of putting a kid in a chair, in a desk chair, and telling him to sit there for 6 hours. I can't imagine anything more bizarre than that, which is what we do. So kids are going to squirm because that's what they do. Now, that theoretically is a symptom of ADHD. But when you raise the question of, is it problematic? Does it interfere with functioning? To a certain extent, that's going to relate to who the teacher is and how much tolerance the teacher has and how many squirmy kids are in the class. Because, you know, you give that kid a label and you put him on medication, he's going to do better. So let me turn to you, Ari. What are the criteria? What are we looking at, both kids and adults?
Right. Well, I think, you know, first of all, I think the thing to keep in mind is kind of, as you're pointing out, the symptoms that are displayed are partly a function of the individual in terms of what they bring to the table, but also what are the demands on the person. So certain teachers, you know, let's face it, are going to elicit kind of more ADHD-type symptoms, perhaps in, you know, much of the class. The difference is that the folks who truly do have ADHD are much more at the thinner end of the bell curves. They don't squirm a little bit, they squirm a lot. They don't forget their homework sometimes, they forget their homework a lot of the time. That it's really, it's a matter of degree more so than a black and white yes or no.
Same with adults.
Absolutely, same with adults.
And I think to add to that, another point that's worth considering is that we're talking about persistent impairment over time and across situations. So in the event of you have some teacher who's, you know, a great teacher who can really work with a student who has problems with restlessness and sitting still, what we're looking for is to what extent do these symptoms persist in third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade, sixth grade? Are the teachers saying the same thing year after year about this person's difficulty along the lines of ADHD symptoms? Because if you have it just 1 year, or it's an idiosyncratic kind of a thing where it's just a chemistry problem between the student and one teacher and it doesn't persist, it's less likely that that's going to be ADHD. We're really looking for patterns over time.
So let's jump ahead a couple of generations, and now we've got adults. What are we looking for? When would an adult come in with a diagnosis, asking for diagnosis?
Well, many times adults come in, they come in for a variety of reasons. They may come in from as simple a reason as reading about ADHD in a magazine or seeing it portrayed in the media on television or in the newspaper. More often, they'll come in from a referral from a therapist or from a mental health professional they've been seeing. Or they might have problems in the workplace or in their marriages or in their home functioning.
Like what kind of problems?
Problems with getting, you know, for example, in the workplace, they might have problems with getting fired, with getting along with coworkers, with being late for work, with not doing their job effectively. With some oppositionality in the workplace.
It sounds like you're describing the kid in school with an adult body now.
Many of the symptoms that we see in childhood also continue on into the adult functioning. If there's one symptom that tends to remit a little bit, it's the hyperactivity. So we may not see as great a degree of hyperactivity in some adults as we might in the children. But generally, the impulsivity and the coexisting oppositionality lots of times continues into adult function.
Let's go to the phones. No surprise here. We've got lots of people who are waiting to join the conversation. We'll start with John. John, hi. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Gottlieb.
Hi.
I'm a... an adult. I was diagnosed with ADD in my late 40s. And basically, highly intelligent, highly creative, but my physical world is very chaotic. I need structure provided by a third person. Without that, things get messy very quickly, and beyond messy, a little bit longer than that.
When you said you were diagnosed in your 40s, what was happening before that?
I was married at the time, and a lot of it was, my daily life covered up, if you will, by my wife, you know, with reminders and things. My workplace, my desk was always very, very messy. I was a practicing lawyer, I had papers, piles on my desk, piles on the floor, piles in the filing cabinet, on top of the filing cabinet. It was very stressful. I graduated high school at 16, and it took me the next 16 years to get through college because I got bored very easy, dropped out. Drugs and alcohol, went back to college. Even my best semester, I had all A's except one. I failed the course because I just didn't go because I found it very boring.
Huh. Ari, you know, you'd listen to a story like John's, and you'd say, well, this is just somebody who's obstinate and travels to, you know, his own drummer.
Mm-hmm. You know, what I would say to that is, if someone had the choice, why would they go through this stuff? Obviously, he's a bright guy, he's a capable guy, and yet he's had, unfortunately, very typical struggles. Troubles at work, not necessarily in doing the work itself, but in managing the various other aspects of the work, like staying organized and keeping track of things. Trouble with relationships has been a problem for him. You know, sounds like it, I don't know, I guess it, we can't say it can cause the divorce, but I'm sure it didn't make it any better. Absolutely trouble in college, that's a very common sort of thing. Like with Chrissy, the lack of structure really winds up causing problems for these folks. So, you know, he's had a lot of struggles along the way that I can only assume he wouldn't go through if he had the choice not to.
So, John, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
So, after your diagnosis, how's your life now? And how are you coping with it?
I've been various combinations of various drugs. Nothing has really been that sort of eye-opening experience that a lot of people get from using stimulants. My life is still very chaotic.
You talked about a third person. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, for instance, when I was married, I mean, you know, things like keys, wallet, remembering to do this, that, or the other thing, my wife would, you know, key me up. But without that, you know, I mean, I can, distraction, you know, is the hallmark of ADD. And to give you an idea, you know, I can go from the kitchen to another room planning to do X. And on the way, I pass a couple of old X's, and I said, oh, I was going to do that. And then some other X grabs my attention, and what I was going to do in a living room doesn't get done.
Gotcha.
But adds to the list of distractions, because the next time I'm doing something else and I think about that,
so
it's a distraction.
It sounds like you and your brain need help. John, I appreciate your calling in, and I do wish you the best. And we're gonna hear later in the show about that third person thing, and I think a lot of people with ADHD need a third person, and they might be available. We might discover they're available. Thanks so much for your call. We've got to take a break. I just have a quick question for you, Kevin. You've been in the field for 20 years.
Uh-huh.
Clearly, we're diagnosing it more in adults and children. Is there more ADHD, do you think, or do you just think we're better diagnostically?
No, I don't necessarily think there's more than there used to be 20 years ago. I think our awareness has increased and our sophistication in being able to assess and diagnose it accurately has increased. And clearly the awareness of the disorder, I mean, 20, 25 years ago, the awareness of this disorder in adults was very, very limited. In fact, it used to be thought of in years past that this was purely a childhood disorder and that by the onset of adolescence and early adulthood, by definition, it went away. And we now know that that's not the case. As you said earlier, about 70% of children with ADHD will continue to be symptomatic enough to meet the criteria as an adult.
There's a reason why Edward Halliwell's book, Driven to Distraction, the first public book on adult ADHD, there's a reason why that sold millions of copies. It was on the bestseller list. He did strike a note.
Yeah, around that time, 1995, there was an explosion of awareness of adult ADHD, and that book was a major reason why.
We're going to have to take a short break. When we do, I want to talk about treatment options and what can be done. We're going to get to the callers. We've got lots and lots of callers. We're talking about adult ADHD. I do want to mention that Chester County ADHD is having a conference on February 23rd from 8 a.m. to 12:45 p.m. You can find out more about the conference at chadd.org. ADD.org. That's CH for Chester County, ADD.org. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about adult ADHD. My guests are Kevin Murphy, joins us on the phone. He's president of the Adult ADHD Clinic in Central Mass. He's co-author of ADHD and Adults, What the Science Says. I'm joined here in the studio by Ari Tuckman, a psychologist in Westchester, and he's the author of Integrative Treatment for Adult ADHD. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Are you concerned about a loved one who is using drugs or drinking too much? You may be eligible to participate in research conducted by the Treatment Research Institute. As part of the study, you'll be asked to attend up to 14 sessions with a family trainer and will be compensated for completing questionnaires on a weekly and monthly basis. For details, 877-I-WORRY-2, 877-496-7792. The Family Training Program supports WHYY.
In 1960, presidential candidate John F. Kennedy urged Americans not to let his religion affect how they voted. In 2000, George W. Bush stated Jesus was his favorite philosopher. How did Americans come to expect candidates to discuss their religious views? On the next Fresh Air, Randall Balmer talks about his book, God in the White House. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about adult ADD. Technically, it's ADHD. My guests are a psychologist, Ari Tuckman. He's in Westchester. He's written Integrative Treatment for Adult ADHD. I'm also joined on the phone by Kevin Murphy. He's a psychologist, president of the Adult ADHD Clinic in Central Mass, and he's written ADHD in Adults, What the Science Says. Let me just ask you quickly, Kevin, before we go to the phones, what does the science say? What are we learning about ADHD brains?
Well, one of the things that came out of our new book is that this disorder, ADHD, we find is associated with a great deal of impairments in adult functioning, that it's not a benign disorder, it's not a disorder that just has minor implications in adult functioning, but in fact, it's associated with a great deal of difficulty in areas of educational attainment, in financial problems, in the workplace, in marriages, in driving, in risky sexual behavior, and in things like lifestyle functioning, like smoking and increased alcohol use and dietary problems and things like that. So it's a very impairing disorder.
Some of what you're describing sounds like stimulus-seeking behavior, you know, that we typically attribute to some high-risk adolescents, the ones who drive fast, who take more risks than the other. These behaviors sound somewhat parallel. I wonder if they live near each other in the brain. Do we know that?
Well, the area of the brain that we talk about in ADHD is called the prefrontal cortex, and it's an area of the brain that is responsible for what we call executive functioning, or being able to sit down and plan ahead, focus, sustain concentration, proactive planning, thinking ahead, and being able to regulate one's behavior. And that seems to be not functioning properly in an ADHD brain as compared to non-ADHD brains. And we are able to see these things more clearly with the technology that exists today than we used to have 20 years ago.
Yeah, Ari, I bring up the issue with Kevin about stimulus-seeking behavior, and I know they're not exactly the same thing, but, you know, that language, stimulus-seeking behavior, and we know with ADHD, stimulants calms down the brain. So, in a way, is the brain seeking stimulation?
Well, I think probably it is. And, you know, when it comes to folks with ADHD, particularly those who have the hyperactive or impulsive subtype, as opposed to those who have just the inattentive subtype, you know, risky behavior is one of those things that you look for, that they're kind of pushing the envelope in a way that other kids are not. And unfortunately, they're also getting themselves into trouble because, you know, you can only roll the dice so many times before something right. turns out bad.
Right. Let's go back to the phones. We've got MC on the line.
MC? Hi, how are you?
Good.
My brother-in-law was diagnosed in high school, and he was taking medication and then did extremely well on a roll, all that sort of thing. And then he decided when he got into college, he didn't need the medication anymore, ended up dropping out of college, didn't tell anybody he dropped out of college. Right now, he can't hold down a job. He goes from one relationship to another. He actually moves in with women. The one time he tried to live independently on his own, it failed miserably. He was kicked out of his apartment. He needed to live in a hotel. So my question is how to approach somebody when they don't see there's a problem, but you know that if they could just get the help and the medication that they need, their life would be completely different.
You know, I asked a question earlier. He said that was a $1 million question. I think yours is the $1 million question, not just about ADHD, but anything else. Ari, you have any thoughts for MC?
Sure, absolutely. I think what I would do is I would sit him down and just have an honest discussion with him about, you know, basically, is this working for you? Because it seems to me like it isn't. It seems mm-hmm. to me like there are some things that you can do to make your life better. Unfortunately, I think for a lot of folks with ADHD, particularly after a lifetime of difficulties, I think they get to a point of not believing that anything is going to help. And, mm-hmm. you know, given their track record, unfortunately, there's a fair bit of wisdom in that. So what I would suggest is really addressing the ADHD very explicitly, finding people, providers, professionals who really understand ADHD and its many different aspects, and can really help him get on top of it and begin to make some changes in his life.
Well, I know a lot of people are concerned. MC, thanks for your call, and I hope that was helpful. I know a lot of people are concerned about medication and the implications of medication. Early on, we heard from Chrissy, who was diagnosed with ADHD when she was an adult. She spoke with Elisa Walters and brought up her concerns about taking Adderall. Let's listen.
My biggest concern now is that Adderall is a stimulant. It's known to raise your heart rate and your blood pressure, which it's not good for you. You know, and that's something that I worry about. I worry about the side effects of that. Also, being a female, worrying about when I do choose to have children, am I going to be done with the Adderall already, or am I going to have to make a fast break from it where I won't be able to make whatever adjustments I need to make in my life? The long term is really what makes me nervous. Like, the right here, right now, I know I have it under control. I have the Adderall when I need it. I don't have to take it when I don't. But it's that future. It's that I still have to establish myself without it.
Well, what about other alternatives, other outlets and channels in your life? Is there anything that you have found that has worked for you, kind of help you channel those emotions and those feelings that doesn't include Adderall?
Exercise, for sure. I also think recognizing my own patterns and tendencies. I know what sets me off. I know my physical reaction to certain things, whether it be emotional or, for example, if I'm getting angry with something or if I'm frustrated, I know now the pattern of what reaction happens to me physiologically, which is major. So I try and thwart that at one point and say, okay, I'm not going to let this take me there, you know. And it doesn't work all the time, but it's something that definitely has taken me a number of years to recognize, but I try to really avoid the turning stomach or the anxiety feeling where I say, okay, don't take the next step, Christy, don't take it that next step further. And that's something for me that I felt comes with age. I don't feel like that's something you can really tell a child.
That was Chrissy speaking with our associate producer, Elisa Walters. Kevin, so what do we know about the long-term effects of taking these drugs?
Well, we don't know from scientific study. For example, we haven't done any 30, 40, 50-year longitudinal study
on the effects of these medications over time. So from a scientific standpoint, we can't sit and tell somebody there's no long-term risks. On the other hand, we've been using stimulants in this country a lot for the past 60 years, and there's nothing in the literature that would suggest that there's any kind of problematic long-term outcomes. It's not associated with problems. For example, we're not seeing increased levels of addiction or cancer or physical or psychiatric problems associated with the use of this medication. And for the lion's share of people, for the overwhelming majority of people, the benefits of taking the stimulant medications, if they have true ADHD, far outweigh the side effects or the fear of long-term problems down the line. So I think that most of my patients would very readily agree to take the medication given the benefits that they're getting currently, even though they may have some concern about the long-term use of it.
Ari, one of my concerns about the medication, and I alluded to it earlier, is that for those who are distractible and might mm-hmm. not fit that threshold of ADHD, people like me and millions of others, they can go to their family doc, get Ritalin or Concerta or one of the others, and it helps.
Right.
And so is that something we ought to be doing? I mean, I'm sure the pharmaceutical industry is pretty happy about that.
Well, I mean, I think when it comes to any kind of treatment, the first step is proper, appropriate diagnosis. If you get the diagnosis wrong, your treatment can't really be all that effective. So the first and most important thing is, as Kevin said and as I've said before, you got to get the diagnosis right. Really do a thorough evaluation. Make sure this is ADHD, not just simply being overwhelmed. So
I want to stop you there.
Yeah.
Define thorough evaluation. I trust we're mm-hmm. talking about more than one 45-minute interview.
Right, absolutely.
Tell me what we should be doing.
Well, when it comes to doing a thorough evaluation, the way that I do it is a two-hour interview, and I'll meet with, if it's an adult with ADHD, meet with them, perhaps a romantic partner or a parent. If it's a teen, then absolutely include a parent. And look at not only what's going on now, but also what's gone on in the past. And as Kevin had said, you know, bringing copies of report cards or other pieces of hard data that we can confirm how they were doing in the past. And we're looking not just for ADHD symptoms. We're also looking for, is this actually really more anxiety or depression or something like that rather than ADHD? Or, you know, the other possibility is that it's ADHD and also anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder, substance use, other things of that sort. So you're really looking at both sides of that, the ADHD as well as the other things that can look like ADHD.
And if it is depression or even mm-hmm. bipolar disorder, mm-hmm. we're talking about a whole different treatment approach.
Right.
How do you parse that out? You've got to do more than just looking at interviewing people mm-hmm. on report cards.
Well, actually, you know, what you're looking for is the subtle differences in some of the secondary features. So, for example, someone who's depressed is going to have a different profile than someone who has ADHD. One of the things that's different is someone who has ADHD will have had difficulties from at least middle school, if not earlier. Whereas someone who's depressed, probably they did okay, and then they got depressed and they were doing worse, and then they did better when they feel less depressed. Folks with ADHD will have consistent impairment across their life, across multiple parts of their life, or multiple settings. So in school, but also with friends, or at work, but also with their spouse. So you're looking for difficulties across these various areas. And in ways that don't look the same as someone who's just depressed, don't look the same as someone who's just anxious or whatever.
So if you, the take-home message I'm hearing mm-hmm. from you is if you think you have ADHD or your child does, you don't want to go to just your pediatrician, and you don't want to go even necessarily to just your neurologist.
Right.
You want to go to somebody who's going to do a thorough evaluation and go beyond simply an interview.
Right. Absolutely, because it's a diagnosis that's far too easy to get wrong. Too many other things can look like ADHD. And if you don't do a good and thorough assessment, best case scenario, what you prescribe is not helpful. Worst case scenario, like you said, if someone has bipolar disorder, you put them on a stimulant, you send them into a manic episode. You think their life was a mess before, wait and see what it looks like once they go manic for a few weeks.
We've got to take a short break. Before we do, I want to turn to you, Kevin. We're talking about, Ari alluded to what we're, the language is comorbidity. Other disorders we see or confuse with ADHD, anxiety, depression, bipolar disorder. What are some coping mechanisms we see? I would imagine there's increased risk of substance abuse for people who are undiagnosed and untreated.
Yeah, there's one of the things we know about ADHD, especially in adults, but children as well, is that there is a great deal of what we call comorbidity associated with ADHD, meaning the existence of other disorders in addition to ADHD. And the typical ones in adolescence are, you know, oppositional defiant disorder and to some extent conduct disorder. And in adults, we see a lot of, you know, depression and anxiety disorders and substance abuse disorders that coexist with ADHD many times.
Who's at more risk?
Who's at more risk?
Yeah, I mean, look across the population. Is it boys, girls, urban, rural, or is it simply genetic?
Well, we know this is a highly genetic and highly familial disorder, and it affects two major groups of people, males and females. So it's not something it's not something that we see only in the United States. We see it in every culture that we've ever studied over the world. It exists in other cultures, maybe looked at differently or called something different, but it certainly exists in other cultures. And the comorbidity really makes the assessment more important. We have to look at not just ADHD, as Ari was saying. We have to be able to disentangle ADHD from anxiety and depression, and partly we do that by the use of rating scales, the use of multiple informants. We want to talk to spouses and parents and get teacher and employment records if we can, and we have to rely on our clinical experience and asking the right questions.
So if I'm a parent or I am an adult and I want to get a diagnosis, I'm going to look around till I find a psychologist or psychiatrist that specializes in ADHD. I don't just want to find a generic psychologist or psychiatrist.
Ideally, that's very true. You really want, because this is a disorder that is often misdiagnosed, overdiagnosed, and underdiagnosed. It's a very confusing disorder and one that's difficult to get right, as Ari said earlier. So it does require some very good experience and training to do this well.
After our break, I want to talk about other treatment options and prevention, and we've got a lot of people also on the phones that have been very patient for a long time. We're talking about adult ADHD. My guests are Ari Tuckman, clinical psychologist in Westchester, and he's written Integrative Treatment for Adult ADHD. Dr. Kevin Murphy joins us on the phone. He's president of the Adult ADHD Clinic of Central Mass. He's co-author of ADHD in Adults, What the Science Says. I'm going to give you that web page again and see if I can get it right. The web address is chestercountychad.org, and Chad is C-H-A-D-D. Chester County Chad, that's children and adults with ADD. And their conference is February 23rd at 8 a.m. The national organization is chad.org, chadd.org, or add.org, and that's for adults with ADD. Well, we'll be back after a very short break. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
Monday night, it's an NPR News special, President Bush's final State of the Union address. I'm Robert Siegel. Join me for live, in-depth coverage, including reaction from NPR political analysts and from members of Congress. You'll also hear the Democrats' response to the president's speech. That's Monday night, an NPR News special, President Bush's final State of the Union address.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
Hello, this is Mitt Romney.
From personal computerized pitches.
Frank suggested that I give you a call about supporting my campaign.
To rapping ringtones.
Obama, Obama. Oh.
The presidential hopefuls are offering some new online campaign stunts, but will that compute with voters?
We're taking them from someone who is engaged and then hopefully to active.
It's high-tech campaigning next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Thank you. And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about adult ADHD. I'm with psychologist Ari Tuckman, who's written Integrative Treatment for Adult ADHD. Joining me on the phone is Dr. Kevin Murphy. He's the co-author of ADHD in Adults, What the Science Says. Ari, do we know anything about prevention? Is there any way to prevent ADHD, or at least minimize the risk of the genes developing?
Unfortunately, there isn't really that much, given that it is such a strongly genetic disorder. Really, the things that you do have control over are the obvious things like during pregnancy, reduce exposure to nicotine and alcohol and lead. Ideally prevent troubles during childbirth. That's sort of an obvious one. Other sorts of difficulties like that, but it's about 85% genetic, so kind of...
Do you advise against, if there's genes in the family, overstimulating the child? Well, I guess it's not healthy to overstimulate any child with
right.
Einstein never used flashcards and starting to teach them algebra when they're crawling around.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't think that things that happen in early childhood are going to have that much of an impact on ADHD beyond just general good parenting strategies. Unfortunately, because it's such a highly genetic disorder, kids with ADHD are quite likely to have a parent with ADHD. So all those sort of obvious good advice sort of things are going to be that much harder for an adult who's probably not been diagnosed with ADHD to manage and to provide to their child. So it becomes this kind of chicken and the egg sort of thing.
Let me flip that around and turn it to you, Kevin. How would you advise a parent with ADHD to care for their child? I mean, you've got a lot of things going on there.
Well, that's actually one of the ways we see a lot of adults is when their kids get diagnosed and they attend a feedback session and see and hear what the ADHD is all about from their child. A lot of times, an adult will say, "Wow, that sounds like my history. I think I have this as well." And it does present additional challenges, especially as Ari was referring to, in when we try to do parent training with to help kids do better in school and at home. Many times, the adults with ADHD can't follow through very well with the homework or do the things that we're asking them to do on a regular basis in the parent training program. So it does present additional challenges, but we have to always instill hope and explain that this is a very treatable disorder and that one that we know how to treat pretty effectively, and we have to look at and inform people about the types of treatments that really seem to help.
Well, I'll tell you, I was going to go to the phones, but as long as you bring up treatment and you say it's very treatable, all we've heard about is medication. Let me turn to you, Ari, because your book title is called Integrative Treatment, so
right.
I trust that's bigger than pills.
Right, absolutely. I have a four-part treatment model that I advocate. First part is education. That just means learn as much as you can about ADHD. So that means attending conferences, reading websites, as much as you can. Second part is medication because, let's face it, the medication that we do have, it's generally quite safe and it's generally quite effective. So I tend to advocate people at least try it and make an informed choice. Third part is coaching, and that means just very specific practical strategies to address the things that the pills don't teach. There's a saying, pills don't teach skills, but skills are a lot easier to learn if you're on the right pills. So that's the coaching piece.
All right, tell us about that, because we hear about coaching a lot. How is it done? Where do you find a coach?
Right.
What does that look like?
Unfortunately, coaching means many things to many different people, and one of the first things that I would ask a potential ADHD coach is, what do you know about ADHD? Just as I would ask a potential therapist, and therapy is the fourth part of the model, but what do you know about ADHD in adults specifically? Because someone who's potentially great as an executive coach, for example, may have very little to offer someone who has ADHD. It'll be obvious strategies that just don't work. So there's various places to find ADHD coaches. But I would want them to have something of a mental health background to know kind of where the line is between coaching and therapy.
I want to bring you back about one paragraph.
Sure.
You said there are various places to find ADHD coaches.
Okay.
Name them.
Sure. There's a number of websites. ADD.org, which is ADA, the ADD Association, their website has a list of ADHD coaches.
Locally.
All across the country. Chad.org, so CHADD.org, has a list. ADDconsults.com is another place that you can find them. Also, ADHDcoaches.org is the national ADHD coaching group that is just beginning to create some actual some standards and expectations for training and experience.
Tell me about economics.
You know, it depends. First of all, a lot of the ADHD coaches practice by phone or email, so geographically it doesn't matter where they're located. Some of them charge anywhere from, you know, $60 an hour, even if that's spread out over the course of a week, to, I don't know, probably some of them charge, you know, $100, $200 an hour. So, you know, I think, and that's, I think, something important to keep in mind, because none of that's going to be insurance reimbursable.
And you said the fourth part. Was psychotherapy. And one of the things I wanted to bring up earlier is not just the ADHD, but the fallout. Kids
Absolutely.
Who have ADHD are just catching hell from adults from the time they're kids till whenever, and they often beat themselves up.
And as adults, they're catching hell from adults also.
Right.
So absolutely, you know, when it comes to the therapy, you're looking at, you're treating the other comorbid stuff like anxiety, depression, excessive substance use, may or may not qualify as addiction, but, you know, excessive use, and effects on self-esteem, effects on their sense of being able to be effective in the world, effects on relationships. It's not just understanding the past in a different way, but also taking that and going forward to help them apply some of the better strategies that are more likely to be effective, and that those strategies come out of a real solid understanding of ADHD. Because unfortunately, every adult with ADHD has gotten a million bits of supposedly helpful advice, like, you should just buy one of those Franklin planners and everything will be organized.
Well, that's like when your family doctor says, you know, you should have less stress in your life.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's a nice thought, but, you know, frankly, it just doesn't work. So for folks with ADHD, the deficits that they have demand more targeted interventions.
Kevin, one of the things I'm hearing from Ari is that medication's great, but not sufficient. Psychotherapy is important, but not sufficient.
Uh-huh.
Agreed?
Yes. Well, we do view medication as the cornerstone of treatment, in part because it's the only treatment that we have that specifically treats the underlying neurological problem in the brain that gives rise to the symptoms in the first place. So ideally, we would, and people we think have bona fide ADHD, we would almost always advocate the use of medication as a starting point, unless they had any medical contraindications to the use of a stimulant,
well,
and then add additional treatments to the medication for an optimal outcome.
Well, that's kind of how I work with depression. Psychotherapy is essential, but if someone's severely depressed, you know, it's like they're trying to get through life with carrying an extra 1,000-pound weight on their shoulders.
Exactly.
Depression's going to be less effective.
And that's why it's important for a therapist to be able to educate a patient. And when we talked earlier about MC, who called in about one of her relatives, you know, who had been on medication in the past and done well and then decided to go off and everything unraveled. You know, sometimes it's very important to educate people about the role of medication and how important it is and what life would be like if they're a good responder. Here's how their life might be different. And sometimes I even explain, you know, what happens to people, what happens in the brain that allows them to do better. And instill some hope in a sense of, you know, I can't promise you that things are going to get better, but I can promise you that if we don't try, we'll never know. And you can always discontinue the medication if you don't like how it makes you feel or it's not working that
Kevin,
well.
Kevin, as long as we're talking about physiology and the brain, we had a caller called in wanting to know about diet and ADHD. Any foods can make it better or worse?
Well, that's kind of an old-fashioned argument dating back to the Feingold diet in the 1970s. And the bottom line is that a lot of science has looked at this as a potential treatment for ADHD, and it doesn't turn out to be very helpful. It's not something that you would treat and expect, you know, good results in terms of altering a diet. Beyond commonsensical kinds of things of having a balanced diet, it's not something that you would promote as a treatment that's going to make a whole lot of difference, when there are other treatments that we know have much more efficacy.
Well, I will say this about diet, though, and Ari, I'd like to hear your reaction. I know when people are more anxious or more depressed, they're going to want to eat more carbs, high fat, you know, things that will, the so-called comfort foods. Mm-hmm. And in the long run, that'll make them feel worse. I would imagine that's the same for ADHD.
Right. Well, and unfortunately, I think the studies that found that ADHD kids ate more kind of junk food than non-ADHD kids, they got the cause and the effect backwards, that they assumed that it was the junk food that made them into ADHD. The trouble is, it's that ADHD kids, like I said earlier, tend to have ADHD parents. In order to eat healthy requires more planning, more foresight, just generally having your life together. ADHD parents have much greater difficulty with that. So as a result, their kids are eating more junk food, less good food. So it's that the ADHD causes eating junk food more than eating junk food causes ADHD. Having said that, of course, you know, we all obviously have an endocrine system and, you know, are affected by blood sugar regulation issues. So if you're eating a bunch of simple carbs and you're jacking up on caffeine as a way to boost your mood, it may help for a moment, but obviously that's going to be short-lived and crash out, and then everything just gets worse.
Anything that can make a prognosis better or worse?
Absolutely. For example, now this isn't something you can control, but those who are more the inattentive subtype, who don't have the hyperactivity or impulsivity, tend to fare better than those with the hyperactivity and impulsivity, but you know, you can't choose that. Generally, I would say more treatment and earlier tends to be more effective. Supportive, caring family, obviously. It's all the obvious kinds of things, to be honest, but it's not just addressing the ADHD, but also treating them as a full person who has other skills and abilities, other interests, and finding other things that they can feel good about themselves about, despite the fact that they do indeed have some places that things don't work out as well.
I would also think another factor, like any other chronic illness, is your prognosis is better when you stop fighting the fact that you have a chronic
right.
illness and must be dealt with as such.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to close. We could do much more on this.
Mm-hmm.
I want to thank you both so much for joining us. My guests have been Kevin Murphy and Ari Tuckman. Murphy is the ADHD Clinic of Central Mass. He's co-author of ADHD in Adults, What the Science Says. Tuckman is clinical psychologist in Westchester, and he's written Integrative Treatment for Adults with ADHD. A couple of web pages, chadd.org and add.org. That conference I spoke to you about is Saturday, February 23rd, and that's chestercounty.org, chestercountychad.org. .org. Well, if you want to reach us, we are at voices@whyy.org. If you want to reach me, I'm at drdangottlieb.com. The engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Gita Simons helped production of today's show. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Alisa Walters did those interviews, and she's our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. Me? I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. Enjoy your week, my friends. Day to day.